Welcome to the Tech Policy Podcast. I'm Evan Schwartztrauber. On today's show, artificial intelligence. It's hard to believe we've done basically 200 episodes, and this is the first one where we're exploring this very exciting topic. And while artificial intelligence does have the potential to revolutionize our society in many ways and benefit people, increase productivity, there's clearly a lot of anxiety about potential job loss and even the end of civilization as we know it, depending on who you ask. So we're going to try to unpack this very complex and deep topic in 20 minutes. But of course, we'll be doing some follow-up episodes after this, as this will be a topic of conversation for many, many years to come. Joining me to discuss this is Elizabeth Clark Polner, Director of Artificial Intelligence at Symbotic, a industrial robotics company.
Thank you for having me.
And Hawaiian shirt enthusiast and Tech Freedom Executive Director Austin Carson is also joining the show. Austin, thanks for joining.
It feels really weird that I'm wearing a dress shirt right now, but I'm excited to be here.
All right. So to start off, I mean, one of the big issues in this discussion is, do we even agree on what the hell it is we're talking about? And it seems like, depending on who you ask, the definitions are all over the map. So let's just start out by defining what is AI.
So people do use different definitions to refer to AI, but it's generally understood to be pattern recognition that's automated. So traditional big data science stipulates that you create a model. You say, I think that this is the data that I have, and I think that this is how it should be put together in order to predict a response. Humans do that, pretty well, but we're biased. And so AI tries to address those biases and says, all right, let's try all the different ways to combine the data that we have in order to make a prediction. Instead of you having to define a priori, I think this is how the problem should be solved, it makes those decisions for you.
So we're kind of familiar with the idea of big data, right? We use services like Gmail, Facebook, and we're, basically in exchange for data, we're getting free services. But is artificial intelligence different than just collecting a bunch of data and trying to figure something out by looking at it?
Yeah. So if you figure something out by looking at it, you might say, all right, here's how I take all of these different pieces of data. The content of your email, the time at which you send your email, the things that you talk about in that email. You take all of those pieces and you put it together and you say, all right, this is how I think I can use these pieces of information. That would be what people typically refer to as big data. Artificial intelligence takes all of those decisions out of the hands of humans. So it says, all right, maybe I have 5 different pieces of data here that I can use. Let me try to combine it and recombine it in every possible way to get to a specific outcome. So let me think about how I can use the content of your email, the metadata, the timing which you send it to, the people to whom you're sending your email. And let me think about all of the different ways that I can use this to predict, for example, what you may want to buy. The ideas behind AI today are not new. They're not conceptually new. These ideas have been around since the 50s and the 60s. The hurdle was that we never had the data to run them on at scale, nor the computational power to be able to actually run that data through these algorithms. So the algorithms themselves are about 50 or 60 years old, but it wasn't until the turn of the century, the 21st century, that we actually had the ability to try these ideas out.
So, Austin, I've already mentioned how, depending on who you ask, you get like radically different definitions of artificial intelligence. Would you agree with what you've heard so far, or do you have kind of a different sense of what AI is?
No, I definitely agree with that. And it's actually nice to hear it phrased in the context of pattern recognition, of taking out the human element of looking and using your own mental models to try to extrapolate something from data, and then using the data itself through these algorithms. I mean, it's really interesting to hear it described. There was a great article in the New York Times talking about how Google Translate has been dramatically improved through artificial intelligence, and they describe what the process looks like mathematically. It's like an 1100 dimension matrix of numbers that they're ultimately using this deduction to pull out what the differences are, what the common themes are, whatever. It's a deductive exercise in a huge scale. And that's a lot different from like the Terminator picture that you may get on one hand, or the idea that the machine has its own mental model from which it can extrapolate a conclusion from a small set of information like our own minds operate. So for as far as like artificial narrow intelligence goes, or specific intelligence, that's exactly what I would consider to be the case.
Yeah, so most implementations today, and I think the Google Translate example is a good one, because one of the points that the New York Times article that you referred to made was that we get a lot better by taking all of these data and kind of brute forcing an answer. But the price that we pay is that we don't understand how that answer is reached. So when people talk about artificial intelligence today, usually what they mean, and they're talking about, say, a commercial implementation, not research. Usually what they mean is what's called a supervised model. So we take one data set, say, you know, a set of translations. I have the same sentence in English and the same sentence in French. And then we take what's called a neural network, and we say, all right, how do we get from point A to point B? But we know what point A is, and we know what point B is. I want to take this sentence in English, and I want to translate it to the sentence in French. And the artificial intelligence that we use today commercially just brute forces an answer. Let me look at all possible ways to get from A to B. I'll see what way is most accurate, and then I use that in the future. In that scenario, we know where we came from and we know where we're going. We don't know how we got there. This is fine if you are doing translation. It's not fine if you're using artificial intelligence, for example, to make decisions about parole. You know, who's a risk, you know, for reoffending? Where it gets a little bit more difficult is what's called unsupervised learning. You know, where we have where we're coming from, but we don't necessarily know where we're going. You know, so I understand, for example, this becomes really interesting in like medical technology. You know, I understand I might have a set of people who have breast cancer, you know, and I want to predict, what will happen to that cancer? Will it grow? You know, will it not? And, you know, unsupervised models are useful for understanding, for example, you know, right now what we refer to as breast cancer is probably 100 different cancers. And we're using these models to say, all right, how do we, you know, differentiate one cancer type from the rest? Because humans are bad at looking at, you know, we group things. We say, okay, this is a breast cancer, this is a bone cancer, this is a brain cancer. We turn out to be bad at defining the B. What's the category we want to predict? But that, again, you know, that becomes unsupervised models become difficult, again, when you talk about things like, you know, people are using them right now to define buckets of credit scores, you know, or buckets of insurance premiums. And they're creating buckets that might be societally distasteful. You know, we got into this. There was an NPR story, a ProPublica story, I think earlier this week, or maybe the end of last week, where they were talking about Facebook ad categories. And Facebook turned out to be selling ads to different, you know, they sell ads and you can target different buckets of people. But one of the buckets that their algorithms had created automatically was Jew haters.
Right.
And no human had you know, outlined this bucket, but it was just created. It was a data-driven bucket. And that's where you start to get into a question of, you know, how do we want to think about this? How do we want to, you know, look at it? How might we want to regulate it? That's where it gets a little hairier.
Well, so, yeah, you've basically got a situation where, you know, taking the human element out, the deliberateness of looking at big data, you have step one, data. Step two, unclear. Step three, result. Right. And we're trying to figure out what
sounds
the hell
like
that
underpants gnomes.
Exact. That was my reference. Thank you.
Not sure what that is, but I'm going to immediately go look it up.
We love our South Park references here on the Tech Policy Podcast. I will refer you all to that episode if you want to understand that. But most people's conception of artificial intelligence is driven by dystopian sci-fi. This is something that Austin talked about at our inaugural policy summit. It's Terminator. It's Stephen Hawking and Elon Musk stoking those fears. You know, it's one thing to have movies that predict the end of the world. It's another thing to have very smart, well-respected people in society making similar doomsday predictions, which can be kind of frightening. But you've mentioned all these other areas where artificial intelligence comes into play. Austin, for the most part, what is the average person's interaction with this technology on a daily basis? Like, we're trying to take a very complicated subject here and relate it to the average person. And really, they might go through their lives not realizing how AI is impacting them. All they're thinking is job loss or end of the world.
Right. So, well, first of all, I want to go back to the point you just made about Elon Musk and Stephen Hawking. And Elon, I hope you're listening. I love you if you are. But really, it's one thing to say that we should not have automated killing machines. Great point, probably, until we really understand how all this is functioning and greatly develop the science behind, like,
current implementation.
Or ever.
We should probably never have automated killing machines.
But I mean, like, not automated killing machines, but, like, things that are, like, weapons of war. Like, embedding any type of autonomous process in weapons of war needs to be done with utmost caution. And I think no matter what, at any point, there should probably be a human not just pulling the trigger, but having some like deep understanding of what that means so we don't get into this disgusting Black Mirror-ish world, right?
Yeah.
But to then go from there to his tweets, to reduce down that letter that they all did to 140 characters that's just lighting up all these state senators and local representatives and then greatly conflating all this is terrible practice. Because if we don't look at this seriously and if we go between like hyperbolic extremes, we'll literally never be able to do something responsible and reasonable about it because that fear is going to extrapolate extrapolate into everything. But to your actual question, right. A friendly, happy land.
Yes.
Like, artificial intelligence is currently what's making your predictions on your shopping cart more accurate. It's what's making Siri, when you ask Siri, where did I park my car? That's how Siri knows where you parked your car, because it understands like some general reduction of what like the phone's movements and the different sensors picking things up means in context of a car, right?
Right.
Like, I was just speaking to some folks who make those Ring video doorbells yesterday, and part of their like neighborhood security implementation is that there's a common audio visual input whenever somebody's stealing a package from the front of your house. And so you're going to get a flag that like, hey, the stuff in front of your house looks like, to our artificial intelligence algorithm, somebody's stealing some stuff, maybe check it out. Those are all very positive things. But you also get like automated calendar additions. You also get, you know, your responses on your emails that are predicted ahead of time. So all these little life, like slight nudges towards something easier are where we are right now. And they're baked in all over the place. Right.
And I think, what's most interesting is that these are not different on a conceptual level than the algorithms with which people are a lot more familiar. When you log on to Amazon and when I log on to Amazon, we see different prices for different products. That's their AI algorithm. When we log on to buy a plane ticket, you see different prices, maybe today versus tomorrow. That's an algorithm learning what is the value of this ticket at this time on this day to this person. People are not surprised by this, but they are surprised by, so for example, they're used to the plane ticket example. They might be less used to the Amazon example. But under the covers, these things are exactly the same.
Yeah, and people are used to set prices in the grocery store, and they're still trying to figure out what it means to have supply and demand be baked into the AI, which might be a much more efficient way of allocating resources and prices, but they're so used to, when I go, the price of the orange, this is the price. And why is it fluctuating, right? That might be very jarring to someone to see that online.
And there's a cottage industry just in helping people become more comfortable with these things. Otis Elevator, when elevators first became automated, I had an uncle who was an elevator operator in the Capitol building. We no longer have elevator operators. The same way, at some point, we won't have car drivers. Yeah, but people were incredibly uncomfortable with the idea that there's no human operating the pulleys. And so, they had to, there was a whole process that they went through to say, all right, how do we get people both to become aware of what's happening and become comfortable with it? And in the end, what they did was add an emergency stop button, which in most cases didn't do anything, but allowed people to become more comfortable with the technology and say, feel like they had some agency, some control over it. But this, again, isn't conceptually different than what we'll have to do, with all of these pieces. I think, the question becomes, the operation of a simple, a pulley system for an elevator is understandable. The operation of a lot of these algorithms, just because they're running at scale, they're using so many data points, on the order of millions and billions, that it becomes a lot harder to wrap your mind around. And so the question becomes, how do we make this understandable to people? How do we change our education system and change the way we communicate about these things to make them digestible?
Yeah, and actually, to that point, I think that there is legitimate responsibility on the part of everybody who's on the cutting edge of these things to have that like educational outreach to everybody and to make it clear in as much as they possibly can how those decisions are made. And I understand this is still a developing science. I understand this is going to be an ongoing process. But to focus upon it, understanding that if you don't do that in the short term because you're focused on just trying to maximize the immediate benefits of it for yourself, then in the medium term, you're going to have people regulating you and pulling you in front of congressional committees to just rake you over the coals. And I also think, most importantly, like, this is an opportunity to have more objective decision making from a broader perspective than people are subjectively generally able to do, right? So we have the opportunity for like real honesty for the first time, to a certain extent, about what data and what like our actions and lives and things are doing, right? Like, on a just data-driven numerical scale. The flip side of that is, if we aren't mindful about it, and if we don't have people proactively trying to bridge the gap between abstract numbers and humans and like what our lives are and how we feel and think about things, then we're going to lose the ability to do so, because we're going to unconsciously bake in all the things that suck about what we do now, and then people aren't going to trust it. And rebuilding that trust for something so opaque and gigantic and scary if it's done wrong, is going to be almost impossible.
So getting to that, I like to think that the vast majority of use of technology is for good. There's always going to be bad actors. Even within that good, there's well-intentioned action that then backfires. Mm-hmm. So if you think about the NSA example, a lot of the same technology that is used to help collect data, to better target ads to consumers, to provide free web services, that technology can be used to surveil. And while the government would tell us that it is trying to keep us safe, and I believe them, that doesn't mean that those surveillance practices do not have negative consequences for civil liberties. Now, taking that example to AI, so many benefits, right? Siri, things like that, better ticket prices, whatever it is. Of course, if artificial intelligence is going to be more and more ingrained in our lives in the future, it will be used by government. Now, let's take the Boston Marathon example, the horrific terrorist attack in Boston. How did artificial intelligence play a role in investigating and prosecuting that crime?
So Georgetown actually put out a really interesting paper in the spring that demonstrated that one in every two adult Americans have their face in a law enforcement recognition database.
And we did a podcast about that.
Well, it's a really interesting topic. And I think one of the kind of overarching points that is important to keep in mind when having these conversations generally, is how much data there is about you that's out there and you don't know it. So in the private sector, this is how we pay. We get all these services for free, and this is how we pay in our data, and we're unaware. But even in the public sector, there's a lot of information that's out there that people don't know. So people saw that report and everybody was incredibly surprised. And then you ask them to open their wallet and you say, what do you have in there? You have a driver's license. What's on your driver's license? It's a picture. You went in, you had your picture taken. You were fully aware of what you were doing. Your picture's also in your passport. It's on probably, any number of other state identification documents. But one of the things that Boston did in the aftermath of the bombing that got some attention they were looking for the perpetrators. They had some idea for whom they were looking, and they had a picture, and they were looking through every video camera that they could find, every database, everything, and just combing through writ large. It works pretty well. Facial recognition is one example of something that seems to be very difficult, and mathematically, computationally, it is, but where we have a ton of data, where there are a lot of pictures out there of people. And we've become really good at utilizing it. Your phone you can now unlock with your face. That's not trivial, and it's incredibly powerful. And a face is more unique, in fact, than a fingerprint. To the extent that more unique is not binary.
Right. And of course,
I dislike there my own use of the term.
Yeah, well, for some of us, like Evan's a beautiful man, but I've seen some of them around town that look pretty similar, so maybe not as special as we'd like to believe in the end.
But most Americans will be willing to sacrifice some sense of privacy for security, right? They'll say, look, if you know the guy, there was a bombing, that's some type of probable cause, and it's not like they're using it constantly for all sorts of nefarious purposes. If they're going after the bomber, all right, fine. If my face gets caught up in the dragnet, but you end up catching the guy and you prosecute the crime, and it's a good outcome, right? But then it gets a little bit more dicey when you get into things like predictive policing. Now you have police departments all around the country, particularly in New Jersey, I believe, that are looking at this. They're saying, look, we have data about people getting arrested, and then they come back and get arrested again. And we have data about where people live. And are we going to start doing things differently, whether that's allocating police to different neighborhoods, whether we start putting people in jail for longer because we know that they're going to come back and the recidivism rate's going to be higher? That gets a little dicey. And, we brought up earlier how the step two, right, where we just don't know how the AI got to the conclusion, but we had the first part of the data collection and then the third part of the result. That could get really bad for a defense attorney. How is a defense attorney who's not an AI expert, who hasn't seen the algorithm, going to prove that the New Jersey Police Department misused AI? So how should government deal with AI fails, as my colleague Ash suggested I ask you?
So I think the one thing that people can do here, and this is receiving some attention lately, is to look at what they call the training set. So we talked about, you use data, I have A and I have B, and I want to figure out how to get between the two. But what you want to do is look at A, and you want to say, all right, What are the data on which we're training our algorithms? Because that's where algorithms learn bias. Just as a human isn't born with biases but learns them over the course of life, algorithms have no inherent biases, but they learn them by virtue of the way in which they're trained. And you can look at the training set and say, are there correlations in here that might be problematic from a public policy perspective? You know, part of the problem with using these algorithms to decide whether or not somebody should be released from or remain in prison, for example, in parole decisions, is that there are correlations in the data already. There are associations, for example, between things like race and recidivism, which have nothing to do with race. There's no inherent quality that makes you more or less likely to reoffend. However, they're spurious correlations, but they are in the training set. And therefore, your algorithm learns that correlation. Your algorithm doesn't learn that maybe it's because, you live in a neighborhood where there are few opportunities and there are lots of gangs and violence, and you're therefore more likely to be caught up, in a, law enforcement, kind of a net, a snafu that, has nothing to do with your inherent behavior.
Yeah, and that's when a human being looks at crime statistics and they see that like people from a very bad neighborhood are ending up in jail, they make that connection. They understand that there are reasons that the numbers might be skewed that way, but doesn't
even humans are actually pretty bad at this. But they can. Humans can understand.
Yeah, we have a criminal justice reform movement, right?
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, we have a criminal justice reform. Their reform is needed because humans are bad at this. But the point is that humans are capable of recognizing that they're bad and then asking for reform. And right now, the types of algorithms we're implementing are not capable of doing that. So they can't see, all right, this is a correlation, but a correlation based on something that's spurious and that I, in fact, vehemently don't want as part of my public policy. And so, what you end up with when you train algorithms on these biased data sets are algorithms that perpetuate the status quo. And, that's an area where we need oversight, and the way in which to implement it is to look at the data on which you're training these algorithms.
And tech freedom, we've talked about techno panic before. This is something that Adam Thier at the Mercatus Center talks about, where you want to realize the benefits of artificial intelligence for society. If you have the potential for productivity gains, price reductions, just all sorts of really cool things coming down the pike, but the news coverage and the pop culture always focus on the bad. And we've identified some legitimate concerns here: facial recognition, predictive policing, parole, sentencing being affected by discriminatory algorithms. But we don't want to give up the good because of the bad. And yes, a city police department might be doing something. We do not have a federal framework for how to deal with this right now. So Senator Cantwell from Washington State introduced a bill that would have the Commerce Department setting up an advisory committee. Seems fairly benign. But Austin, you come from the Hill. You spent 7 years working in government. Is the federal government even ready to be grappling with this issue? And what do you think the various roles of government, whether it's state, local, and federal, should be in dealing with this issue, given that it's being used already?
So I'm going to do the lazy thing and go like a level of abstraction higher.
That's fine. That's why we like you.
The previous point. Thanks, guys. That's why I'm not the lawyer. So to the point of algorithms institutionalizing or solidifying bias, right, perpetuating it over time. Right now, you have disproportionate sentencing, disproportionate parole rates or whatever that are impacted. Even let's go back to like lending, for instance, and like creditworthiness, right? So we're able to start, if you look at it on one hand, you could bake that in forever if you didn't look at it and care, and you just were like, let's just make this as efficient as possible given the current data, right? But you can also look at it in a different way and find a way to approach it with that knowledge that there is bias baked in, and find a way to say, okay, what correlations and what patterns can we find that will allow us to lend to people that we wouldn't normally lend to based upon our super basic, like four categories of information we draw from? Or let's look at recidivism and find what are the signs that people will, like, or what will allow people, or what will help people not go back to jail, or will allow them to like have a better life, or what are characteristics that we may have missed that show people could be ready for parole, or they might benefit from it, or might benefit society, right? So I think part of that is spinning it on its head and trying to find those correlations, as opposed to just taking the massive data set and baking in what it shows, right? Now, to the question of what is the government's role, I think that first and foremost, we simply have to make the federal government writ large, including the legislature, including the executive branch, including the judiciary, have some baseline understanding of what the potential and what the pitfalls are of the technology, how it operates. And I would say, first and foremost, we need to stop relying on, I'm not anybody's the wrong word, but the vast majority of non-practitioners that we're currently relying on, like me, don't have me be telling them what to do about AI, right? Like on a fundamental practical level, I'd like to give the high level guidance that maybe consider these things writ large and here's maybe a plan or a way to think about it. But I want to have people that are actually developing the technology, that understand it, that are researching it, like Lizzie here, to be the ones advising us on how to think about it. Because one of the big things that everybody likes talking about all the time is the trolley problem, right? Everybody's like, yo, we can't have autonomous vehicles because what if there's an old lady on one side and five kids on the other? What's going to happen? We don't know. That's never going to happen.
Yeah, there's, and what's funny is
never going to be a situation in which that happens.
And that's been in every philosophy class.
Pissed off about it, yeah. Right? They hate it. Like, you talk to somebody that is working on autonomous vehicles, and they're just like, for the love of God, if you ask me about the trolley problem, I'm just going to leave right now, you know? But we need to understand that that's a waste of our damn time. And that if we really want to care about this and do it right, we have to figure out what the actual real dangers are, why they manifest themselves, and under what circumstances and what conditions you can mitigate them. And that's my soapbox.
And there's, you know, there's both the regulation end, but also the education end. So Steve Mnuchin in the spring gave an interview where he said...
Treasury Secretary?
Yes. Where he said that he was not at all concerned about robots taking jobs and that we were 50 to 100 years away from that happening. That is categorically incorrect. It's happening now, but what people need to be able to see, and part of the reason it's useful to have some awareness of how these things are developing and how they're being used, is that right now people are automating the jobs that you might guess would be automated. You know, personal assistance, marketing, customer service, route planning while you're driving, basic legal research.
Elevator operation.
What we will get into very quickly, and we already have the ability to do, is automate things that people don't expect. You know, so your basic software developers will be put out of a job. Software will develop itself. It will train itself. This is what's different about AI versus big data, is that it monitors its own performance and it gets better.
Unlike most humans.
That, I think, means that we need to be looking at, not only, so one of the things that the Cantwell bill talks about is, all right, we need to look at how this will impact the economy. Government can use AI for good, and it needs to understand how it can support, how it can use it itself and how it can support use of AI in the private sector, but it also needs to look at who will have opportunities taken from them and how we can restore those opportunities to those people. And so there's a piece here in terms of education, training, operation. NPR in the spring ran a really interesting interview with a guy who had done everything that you would think that you should do. And so he made molds for shoe soles in a rubber factory. And he recognized in the mid-90s, he said, this job isn't going to exist. I need training in computers. And he went and he took out some loans and he went to night school and he got the training he was supposed to get. The problem is, if you're doing this only at night and it takes you 5 years, 6 years to complete your degree, by the time you complete your degree, that degree is outmoded. It is no longer useful because the technology is developing at such a rapid pace. And so we need to think about, when we do things like say, all right, like let's address the education component here. We need to think about how we can do that differently. The model that we currently use to support these retraining programs is insufficient for the current employment environment. And you have to understand how quickly things are developing in order to do that and, which jobs are being targeted.
So I usually ask my guests to close out the show by giving a message for policymakers. You guys have already done that. So we're going to do something a little bit different. Given that AI is the subject of so much anxiety, and I think that that's largely unwarranted when we think about how people freaked out about the television, people freaked out about the car, people freaked out about the automated elevator. Like, people need to just take a step back and realize that all of the same fears about technology have been played out before. And while there might be something unique about artificial intelligence and automation, there is a saying that there is nothing new in this world. So just take a step back, realize that we don't have all the answers, we don't know how this is going to play out, but what is the most exciting thing for each of you coming down the pike? And what should listeners of this podcast be looking out for as a positive sign of how society is changing for the better because of this technology? And I'll start with you, Austin.
This might actually make some people uncomfortable, but I really love it, so I'm going to say it anyways. I actually think that the most exciting thing about artificial intelligence is what I talked about a little bit earlier, which is the ability to be honest about ourselves. Like, we are incredibly bad at being honest about ourselves. We are incredibly bad at noticing our own cognitive biases, and it takes an incredible amount of work for us to overcome them over a period of time, and it's somewhat excruciating because that's a survival instinct, not a rational instinct. We are not rational, we are rationalizing, right? And artificial intelligence will allow us to have information on why we're making decisions, on there's actually a point in Nick Bostrom's book, Superintelligence, where it's kind of like a throwaway and a bunch of other stuff where he's trying to scare the shit out of everybody. Where he's like, artificial intelligence might actually be really good at things that we're weirdly bad at, like, you know, like ethics. And so I would find that personally very exciting if I could have a thing tell me, hey, man, you're being an asshole right now. Maybe stop. Oh, I didn't know.
Yeah, the
it
computer
gets scarier
told me.
Though when it just stops you. It doesn't ask
well,
anymore.
Well, that's all agency. Let's not take our agency. You're right. Let's have we pull the trigger. They just tell us that's probably a terrorist. It's fine.
Yeah. And Lizzie, your favorite thing coming down the pike about this technology?
Well, I think to your point about, you know, things that the humans are bad at, you know, computers are incredibly good at pattern recognition. There are a lot of things that will get a lot better right now. You know, so like radiology will no longer exist, you know, as a profession. Pathology will no longer exist. You know, we'll get a lot better at a lot, you know, there are a lot of interesting applications within, you know, the medical sector, but, you know, like cybersecurity. We're about to become an order of magnitude better at cybersecurity because algorithms, yeah, you know, algorithms can start, you know, I think, you know, what's really cool is when you get into, you know, these things starting to regulate themselves, you know, so algorithms, you know, recognizing human behavior, not just, you know, so that it can sell you things, you know, and better place ads, but also so that it can protect you.
Well, I hope that this podcast made you a little bit more positive about artificial intelligence. And now I recommend you go watch Terminator and Minority Report and then go right back to freaking out and forget everything we said.
And then listen to this again.
Yeah,
and
then just
also watch Minority Report and maybe Psycho Pass for
yeah,
an
just,
anime.
You should just go through you should just go through a constant ebb and flow of freaking out and being positive, and then we'll arrive at a good conclusion. Well, that's it for today. My guests have been Elizabeth Clark Polner, Director of Artificial Intelligence at Symbotic, a industrial robotics company.
Thank you for having me.
And Austin Carson, Tech Freedom's Executive Director, who
He's
is
having
wearing
a hard time keeping
a dress
together.
Shirt right now, and he is laughing because I am so freaking hilarious. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at Tech Freedom. Let us know what you think of the show. We will certainly collect your data and use it in a nefarious way to screw you over. Write a review in the iTunes store. Send us an email, media@techfreedom.org. Always happy to have you on the show if you have something interesting to say. But that's it. We'll see you next time.
The Tech Policy Podcast is produced and distributed by Tech Freedom, a nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank in Washington, D.C. To learn more about our work, make a tax-deductible donation, or find other episodes, find us online at techfreedom.org.